welcome. My name is Michael Pellet, and I'm from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And up there, I teach at the University of Saskatchewan, and am also a pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatchewan, a small church community on the west side of that city. And this week, I'm going to try to bring together the Gospel of Mark, which is the primary gospel appointed for those who are following the Revised Common Lectionary for this church year. And most of our lessons for the season of Pentecost will be from Mark's gospel. So I'm going to try to bring together Mark's gospel with the theme that Holden has chosen this year for its summer program, No Longer Strangers. And so trying to bring together reading through Mark's gospel with that theme in mind, and specifically the notion of community, and what kind of sense of community is evoked from Mark's gospel, and what does Mark's gospel have to tell us about who we are as people of God and as communities of faith. Yesterday, as I started to look at that, already looking at Mark chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We found out that, first of all, while that's kind of a dull, boring beginning to say this is the beginning, on the other hand, it right away makes us into a community and turns us into something that no other character in the gospel is yet, and that is the experts. Because after reading Mark 1, verse 1, you now know something that no one else in the gospel knows, that Jesus is the Son of God. So immediately, in terms of who you are as a community of readers or hearers, you are the experts. You are the insiders. And yet at the same time, you are still always the outsiders reading or listening in to what's going on. And so we have this very paradoxical dimension of insiders and outsiders going on throughout Mark's gospel. The second thing we looked at in terms of this dimension of insiders and outsiders is how Jesus' dynamic with both insiders and outsiders shows that to be simply an insider can still be problematic. We looked at chapter 4, verses 10 to 12, and 33 to 34. And we noted there that in Jesus, who is truth-teller and puts forward who God is and what Jesus was sent to do, that often meets with denial, with fear, and resistance. And that denial and fear and resistance does not simply come about from those who are on the outside, but ironically for Mark, it comes about for those who are on the inside. Because Jesus' way of graciousness, Jesus who is sent as the emissary of God's love, is always upsetting our normal and usually understood ways of living together in community and the ways in which we organize and structure ourselves as community. And so when confronted with that word of Jesus, we often deny or we are afraid, we desert, and we resist. And so I talked about there how we see, for example, that Peter's denial is not just back in chapter 14 in the high priest's courtyard where in front of the servant girl and all the others, Peter denies Jesus. But that denial is kind of going on and unfolding throughout the gospel in terms of Peter having a tough time grasping what this new community of faith and life under God's reign and rule would be all about. And same with the other disciples. They often live in fear. They deny, they resist, and finally they desert. And so, too, there's that sense that goes on. Finally, we looked at one more specific passage. This is called the third passion prediction in Mark's gospel. It starts at Mark chapter 10, verse 32, and it's where Jesus very explicitly and plainly tells the disciples, I am going to Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem, I'm going to be captured by the chief priests. I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles. They're going to mock me, spit on me, flog me, kill me, and 3 days I will be raised. As soon as he says that, James and John, who are supposedly two of the insiders, come up to Jesus and say, Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And Jesus says, sure, what do you want? And they say, we want to sit at your right hand and at your left hand. In other words, we want the power. We want to be the leaders. We want to be the big deals. And again, it's that sense there of how the insiders have not understood at all what Jesus is talking about. And so at that point, Jesus goes on and says, no, my community and the reign and rule of God is such that we're not put together that way. We don't rule like the Gentiles rule, like the Romans rule, where we exercise power and authority to put down people and to keep them under our thumb. But rather, if you want to reign and rule in my way of life, it is going to be as a diaconus, as a deacon, or up at Holden we would translate that, as waitry. And we also then looked at the passages in Mark where he uses this word deacon, either as noun or verb. It occurs in two other places. And in both of those places, that attribute of being a deacon, of being a server, a servant, is attributed to women. And usually women who are very low in terms of social status. They are widows, they are single women, or someone like Mary Magdalene, maybe even a prostitute. So it's with third and fourth class citizens relegated to this level of serving servants that Jesus holds up as the model for leadership in the community. A word that I think tells us that the community of faith as presented by Mark and as declared by Jesus is one that is cross-constituted. It begins and ends in the cross, and it is one of service, not one of control, power, authority, putting others down, but indeed of lifting others up and of being of service to them. So that's what we looked at yesterday. Today, I want to look at the section in Mark here, very ambitious, Mark chapter 1, verses 20, starting at verse 21, through Mark chapter 3, verse 6. And the reason I'm looking at this section is because it's held together. The key word, I think, that is the parenthesis at the beginning and end of this section is the word destroy. In Mark chapter 1, verse 24, this is the first healing that Jesus does of a man with an unclean spirit. And this unclean spirit speaks, and it says in verse 24, have you come to destroy us? So there's that word destroy. That same word destroy will again appear in chapter 3, verse 6, where it reads, "The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him." And so we have in this whole section a notion of conflict between those who are out to destroy Jesus, as we see in chapter 3, verse 6, over against those whom Jesus is going to destroy, or at least the way it's perceived that Jesus is going to destroy. And so we're going to look at this conflict, and what I want to see discuss and I hope help you to see is that the conflict here is in terms of communities and in terms of the way we again constitute and organize ourselves in terms of community. One way to look at it from a Lutheran point of view, and for those of you who aren't Lutheran here, I don't apologize, but this is always a particularly Lutheran question. As one studies Luther, one of the kind of key summaries of looking at Luther is to say, Luther's quest was always, how do I find a gracious God? How do I know with certainty God is gracious? Mark's question, I think, also deals with grace, but is a bit different. It's not so much, how do I find a gracious God, but it's the kind of question, what do you do with this gracious God now that you've found it? In other words, how can we live together as a community in terms of a God of grace? Because a God of grace is a real problem. And the problem for community is this. If we're talking about grace, we're talking about something that is unconditional. To be redundant, I'll talk about unconditional grace. What kind of communities can we have that operate without conditions? Even at Holden, utopia that we all know it is. It's a conditional community. In other words, there's a lot of if-thens going on in order to control you. Like, if you want to eat, then you have to come running when the bell rings. If you want to go on a hike, then you have to show up at 8:30 in the dining hall and pack your lunch. However, if you are not going on a hike, then you better not show up and get a little extra snack. That is verboten. Right? We've got all sorts of conditions, right? If you want to smoke, then you better sit next to a butt cam, right? Put your butt next to the butt cam. If you don't smoke, then you can wander happily to your room. On and on it goes, right? You've got all those little if-then things out of all the announcements, how to clear your table, all the... Right, that's how we live together as communities, right? We've got, right, we call them rules. But we do that stuff all... But now, how do you live together as a community that claims a God who is gracious, a God who is in relationship with us unconditionally, who doesn't say, if you cut your fruit rinds up into square centimeters, then I will forgive you. But says, whether or not you cut up your fruit rinds, you still are forgiven. Now, how do you live? How do we now constitute ourselves as that kind of community? Because after all, we profess to be a people of faith who live by those promises of a gracious God, and therefore we are gracious toward one another. How unconditional are our communities of faith, our churches, congregations, study groups, Holden Village? All that's the right. That's a real problem. How do you live with this unconditional, gracious God? In some senses, it's not a fun being to live with. It's tough. And there's going to be a conflict. The conflict between that kind of unconditional community and all our other ways of living by conditions. And Mark is pointing that out. How does he do that? Scholars who look at literature in general, but particularly biblical literature and all the other literature of antiquity, first century, and so on, note that the kind of sociological, symbolical, literary understandings of things in the literature. For example, when we talk about land or table, we're talking about economic conditions and ways of understanding a community, a society, a culture. When we talk about the village or the house, we're talking about the social dimension of that community or culture. Here's the one that's kind of a tough one for us. When we talk about the synagogue or the sanctuary, we are talking about the political dimension of that society and culture. And when we put all of these together, the economic and the social and the political, then the big umbrella term is the religious dimension. Now that's a little different already than our culture, where by and large we would want to call synagogue or church or whatever the religious. We'd have another realm here for the political, and so we kind of pigeonhole four things here, rather than seeing the religious as the umbrella term under which economics and social and political fit, and they feed into this. And the religious has dimensions in all of that. And what I want to do today as we go through this section is particularly center on synagogue and, if time allows, get to land and table to talk about some of the political, economic, slash religious dimensions of going on here, of what's going on here with this unconditionality of grace. Now, the way things work in terms of your typical conditional community, economically, socially, religiously, is that there is a significant connection that the religious understanding of all of this is put forward in terms of purity codes. That whether you are clean or unclean, or maybe we might talk about it as normal or abnormal, healthy or sick, is a whole dimension of a purity code that again entails economic, social, political, and religious dimensions. And of course, enforcing those kind of purity codes means that there's a question of authority. There's got to be some kind of authority there that, if you will, sanctions those codes. And the kind of authority you have and the mechanism that carries that out becomes very important in terms of the way you hold yourself together as a community. But of course, once you have purity codes and authority, that means you're going to have, if you will, again, pure and impure. And so you're going to have insiders and outsiders. And so within the society as a whole, you're also going to have some kind of institutional alienization. There has to be the other, those who don't fit, the misfits, the impure, the unclean, the dregs of society. Choose your favorite metaphor to put people down. we have all sorts of institutional ways and terms that we use for that kind of alienization. And yet we want to claim that even working through these purity codes with their authority, their alienization, with their religious sanction, we want to claim that indeed that finally will be the way of justice. And that who we are as a community and a society will finally be a just community and a just society. And it's particularly then at this point, with this notion of justice and what constitutes justice in terms of conditionality, unconditionality, purity codes, or something else, that we see Jesus coming into conflict with the authority of his time. And so that's enough talk by introduction. Let's try to get into this a little bit and see what's going on. Let's turn first to Mark chapter 1, verses 21 through 28. The first healing story, exorcism here, and to try to put some of that together. Would someone or two of you like to read that story for us, please?
They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, he entered the synagogue and taught. They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Just then there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. They were all amazed, and they kept on asking one another, "What is this? A new teaching? With authority, he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." At once his fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee.
Thank you. First thing to point out, as Mark sets the context for this story, something that we can quickly overlook, he notes that this happens on a Sabbath in the synagogue. So already, here's where we're located. So if you will, we understand that this story now is going to have both political and religious implications. On the Sabbath, in the synagogue, so we are already talking about what's going to be going on in sacred space and at a sacred time. We're at that point, right, in that space and time which supposedly constitutes us as our most authentic selves. Think about that as Christians, most of us would claim that to be in church on Sunday morning is the place and time where we really, really are who we are. Baptized sons and daughters of God. People of God. That indeed all other times during the week, yes, we're that as well, and we certainly wouldn't deny it or anything. But on Sunday morning in church, that becomes central and focused. And that's the very core of our being and existence. So here's Jesus in the synagogue on the Sabbath, the very center and core of the existence and understanding of that community and that people and who they are. And in that synagogue, at that very center, what happens? He's there teaching, and the people are astounded, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now, what do you think that means? What kind of authority does Jesus have that's different from the authority of the scribes? Maybe first we should ask, Who are the scribes? What do we mean by scribes? If we would want to give a contemporary analogy, who are the scribes of our day and age?
They're lawyers.
They're lawyers?
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Pastors.
They're pastors? Boy, putting lawyers and pastors together. That's kind of humbling for the pastor side of things. I don't care about lawyers. Who else?
Lawgivers, like legislators?
It could be. It can be legislators. Yeah.
Teachers.
Teachers. Yeah.
Accountants.
But of course you're not talking about Holden Village teaching staff. We wouldn't be the scribes. Maybe the directors are, but not us.
Accountants.
Accountants. How are accountants scribes?
They scribe by accounting.
Okay, they
you speak your secret.
All right.
You say elite power?
Huh?
Could you say elite power?
Elite power? They may not have it, but they certainly want to claim it.
Would it be the Torah scholar?
Yeah. Let's put them under places like pastors, teachers. Maybe to make it a little more scholarly, we'll also say, not that those folks are, but we'll say profs. Might just about everybody now. Okay.
Weren't they also keepers of the Torah, the actual books, of the scrolls?
Okay.
So the keepers of holy objects.
The librarians?
So what you're saying is they're all the insiders.
Oh, yes. Precisely. They're the insiders. They're the I mean, if you will, and we've got this, and the scribes, again, different scribes have different dimensions of. But note all these professions, what's their basic tech? Aren't these the folks that keep order in society? Right? That somehow if I get mixed up with the law, I run to my lawyer. If I somehow kind of get mixed up with God, I run to my pastor. If I want to change the way our society, you know, legislators. Teachers, profs, they tell us what the law is and order us and educate us. Librarians make sure all those books are still there. Accountants, well, they particularly help me in terms of tax laws and make sure my bank is balanced. These are all the folks that keep order. Yes?
Where does the tax collector fit in?
Where does the tax collector fit in?
The
tax collector doesn't fit in here because the tax collector, at least in this particular setup, is kind of a patsy or someone who's used by those who have the elite power to do their dirty work. And so they wouldn't at all be considered respectable. Maybe nowadays the tax collector would be what's the repo man? What are they? The person who goes out to repossess your
assessor.
The assessor or something like that. And not to impugn anybody there, but again, these are all noble professions, and the tax collector would not. They would be an outcast. They're definitely an outsider. These are all the insiders. Their authority is the authority of order.
How about doctors?
Doctors, sure, they can come in there too. What kind of authority does Jesus have?
From
the prophets? What kind of authority is that?
Biblical?
Oh, well, certainly aren't the pastors and at least Sunday school teachers and seminary profs going to claim they have biblical authority?
thinking, when they saw what Jesus did, his was a authority with visible power as opposed to just knowledge-based.
Oh, okay, but you don't think that this knowledge and this order also has visible power?
But he was able to pull an unclean spirit out of somebody, and I think that was part of the point of the scripture. I think B read that really well, because it made me see that he can even do that.
Okay,
and they would be amazed with that.
But what are they amazed at? Look there again. When the people are amazed, what are they amazed at?
It's new and with power.
His teaching, right? Mark records none of the folks there are going, "Shine, Ola LaRue, he pulled out a demon." They're going, "Whew, what's this guy saying?" The teaching is what has thrown them into a panic. I mean, in other words, there's other, in the context of the time, there's other miracle workers who can go around casting out demons. That's not even the big deal. The big deal is the teaching. That's where they note a new authority is going on there. So what's his teaching? What's that authority there?
Isn't he like opening up their eyes to see the teaching in a new way? I mean, he's explaining it with new conviction, with new understanding, essentially this road to Emmaus kind of experience where he's kind of opening up eyes to what they all knew already and been taught many times.
Okay, and what's new? You're right. Obviously they're amazed because it's something new. But now when you got to put your finger on it, it kind of gets tough. Yes, please.
Well, the outside is red and the inside is out.
Okay, so there's
is this what he was saying? What Jesus was saying, what they were so astounded about, right?
So what you're saying for Jesus is that it's what? A new order?
Yeah.
All right, a new order.
Verse 22 says, "For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes."
Right.
So he is having an innate authority, which I heard whispered over here. He is having an authority that does not come from a third-party reference, but comes out of exactly who he is.
Maybe.
As divine. Son of
God. Only as an insider would we know that. Nobody else knows that yet.
They don't give him that. You know, the people in the temple recognize the scribes who they are because of their place in society. Jesus comes in and says, "I'm the Son of God." They have no reference to say, "Oh, really?" That's their.
Okay.
We are reading this because we already know the story. We already give him authority to say that.
Yeah. But Jesus doesn't come in saying, "I'm the Son of God," does he?
Carpenter.
At this point, he hasn't taught anything. I mean, and it seems like Mark is setting the reader up here to say, "Well, what's going on here? Let me read further on to discover what there is to be astonished about." Because at this point, he hasn't done much. We're only 20 verses into it. He's been baptized and declared the kingdom of God is at hand, but the reader doesn't know what that is.
Except that that the scribes felt threatened by it. So we know.
Okay. And
well,
back then,
certainly the scribes and the priests wrote their own rules. They're the ones that invented the rules that they could act as authority to the others with the power.
Okay.
And he did not write his own rules. Those rules were the basic ones that were rewritten by these people.
Okay. So that there might be a different way of claiming authority. is what I understand you to be saying.
Yeah, they...
Okay.
They wrote this Torah.
Yeah, but their claim is, but their claim is, isn't it, that that Torah is indeed God's word?
They can claim anything they want, but it was not true. Some of the things they wrote were not true. And I think that writing the rules and exercising this authority was the things that they were doing that the people didn't like particularly. Okay. And,
let's go on. Let's see if we can work our way through this a little more. And that's in terms of looking at the reaction of this unclean spirit to Jesus. Verse 24. This unclean spirit cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth?" Or a New Testament exegete, Vincent Taylor, translates this to say that if the understanding we should get from this, from the Greek, is, "Why do you meddle with us, Jesus of Nazareth?" That the problem here with Jesus, from the perspective of this spirit, is that Jesus is meddlesome. Right? Jesus is beginning to pry into and come into this order where we think he doesn't belong. That the first response, again, of this unclean spirit is a notion of defiance. Next, the next question there. Have you come to destroy us? Note how that defiance is seen kind of as bravado and gives way to fear. That the meddlesome one now is no longer just simply meddlesome, but is now a threat. Right? You can destroy us. And finally then, if you will, this spirit regroups and says, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." That notion of naming within this context, to name someone is to be able to control them. Think about how safe some of you are and how on the edge of treachery others of you are in terms of whether or not I know your name. Because if I know your name, I can now ask a tough question and put you on the spot, right, Nancy?
Yep.
Yep. If I don't know your name, I don't have that kind of control. Because if I say, "What do you think about that, what's your face?" You can hide in that anonymity, right? There's great control in knowing the name. And so here, right, this spirit wants to control just by saying, "I know who you are. I can name you." And it's precisely at that point when, again, control wants to be exercised that Jesus says, "Be silent. Shut up. You're not going to control me." Think about this again when we're thinking about community. Think about those questions or that response of that unclean spirit in terms of the way we as communities act to outsiders or to aliens. Okay. Pick your outsider or alien of choice. Be that an ethnic understanding, Black, Hispanic, Jewish, whatever. Sexual orientation kind of understanding, gay, lesbian, class understanding, rich, poor. What happens when the alien, the other, comes in, comes to your community and wants attention and wants to be heard? Isn't the first reaction often one of defiance and considering that person meddlesome? What's the matter with those gay people? Why can't they just stay in the closet where they belong and leave us alone? Why can't they just behave themselves? Instead of causing all this trouble for all of us good, orderly people. They're just meddlesome. But then, right, it gets a little worse. Because as they keep on in their persistence, whoever this might be, right, let's pick on the blacks for a moment, right, all of a sudden, when they want equality and justice, and they start organizing like Martin Luther King Jr. and having civil rights marches, now they're a threat. We gotta do something about these people. They're getting a little uppity and out of control. So we need to get Bull Connor, you know, put out the dogs and the water cannons on these folks. We gotta show them their place. And then we finally kind of overcome our fears and their threat, and then what we want to do finally is control. Because once we can control, then we've got that nice way of getting them back into our order, our way of power, and then everything is going to be okay again. And the real problem comes in, right? What happens when they won't be controlled? And that's again, think about that as the way God's reign and rule breaks into our lives. Here we've got this whole notion of grace. And grace, if, you know, come on, unconditional God, what do you have to do with me? Stop meddling in my life. I've got a great conditional system worked out. You know, if I do this and live a good life and blah, 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 then I'll live happily ever after. Now, you want to muck that all up? Come on, what have you got? You know, stop meddling in my life, gracious God. And then all of a sudden, that God becomes our fear and our threat is there in terms of, oh, but you know, what if this gracious God could really carry through and do all this stuff? Oh man, now what am I? Right? Now God becomes a real problem. What am I going to do with this God? How am I going to handle that God? But finally, we can regroup, right? And we'll try to control that God. And we'll put him into some kind of nice little church system, a nice little community of faith system where we can maybe talk about a gracious God, but still live a very conditional way. And so, yes, you must believe, you know, if you believe God is gracious, then you're really a Christian. Isn't that interesting how we can conditionalize unconditionality? How we can even turn gospel or grace into law. And many times that's what our communities of faith are so good at. There's that control. And Jesus again says, shut up! None of that stuff. There's that stuff. So there is that new ordering. But what that new ordering now entails from this perspective, what has the scribes and all these other people upset, is they now claim, well, Jesus, the way you're going at things, you are lawless. But Jesus says, and here again, as Rolf suggested, we need to go through a little further. We just begin to get a glimpse of this here. Jesus wants to set an alternative to this notion of order, a sense of justice. And that God's notion of justice, the gracious reign and rule of God, brings together compassion and justice. That those things are not antithetical, but they go hand in hand. and what the rest of chapter 1, 2, up through 3, verse 6 illustrate is that whole way of compassion and justice. And again, the conditions of time are against me. So we'll just look at a few of these things to show where that comes in. To shift for a moment to the whole land table economic point of view of what's going on. First, just the sense of table, something I think is pretty obvious to us. Chapter 2, verses 16, and verse 16. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Again, that whole notion of, okay, who is Jesus in communion with? Who is he eating with? What sense of orderliness can be going on when you are purposefully hanging out with the others, the outsiders, the aliens? Something's wrong there. Maybe for us, the kind of question to ask yourselves in terms of your own communities of faith are, who are invited and who attend your potluck suppers? Any tax collectors and sinners at your latest potluck? And don't existentialize that again to say, oh, well, yeah, I'm a tax collector and sinner. I mean, let's think about that, right? One of our favorite hymns is, "Chief of sinners though I be, everyone else is worse than me." And so, so don't existentialize this too quickly to say I'm the tax collector, and that's the cheap way out, right? Let's stay right here at that land table economic level, right? Who is at your potluck table? Flesh and blood at your potluck table. Remember, I mean, I'm sure pastors know about this. If you're at all into church growth, Donald McGavran and company, successful churches, growing churches are always those that are homogeneous. You find your particular niche and unit and you stick with that. And so if you want to appeal to white, upwardly mobile middle class and say this church is only for those folks and that's your homogeneity, you've got a good chance of success. Or if you will, even if you're in the inner city and you want to appeal to black, lower class, working poor folk and say those are the only people welcome, you've got a chance there for a successful church. But no way is it going to work if you want those white middle class and black working poor to somehow eat at the same table. Not the recipe for church growth. But if that's the case, that also means that we become very exclusive in our understanding of community. Not very inclusive. And so whoever it might, so that from that perspective of black working poor church, all those whites are the tax collectors and sinners. From the perspective of white middle class, it might be all those blacks are tax collectors and sinners, right? What counts there then as tax collector and sinner is the way we have institutionalized our aliens, our other. And the word of Jesus here is somehow God's unconditionality is going to break that down. And that's tough, right? It's not easy. And it's, if you will again, it's not the recipe for success. It's the way of the cross. And how do we overcome those barriers? How do we think about that? Okay, those examples there again, verse 18 and following, the whole notion of why aren't your disciples fasting and following that kind of order. Verses 23 and following, that note, Jesus and the disciples are plucking grain on the Sabbath. clearly a violation of the purity code. Right? No doubt about that. But again, Jesus' response to that is saying what? The Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath. How do we structure and order that? It all comes to a head, a climax in chapter 3, verses 1 to 6, with the story here again of the healing of the man with the withered hand. And note where we are again, chapter 3, verse 1. The synagogue and it's the Sabbath. We find that out in verse 4. So we're back here again to that sacred space and time. And we note here again how Jesus purposefully pushes it. I mean, here's a man, who knows how long he's had this withered hand. Certainly, Jesus could have just whispered to him, "Hey, I'll see you tomorrow. Come back then." And everything would have been okay. I mean, you know, if you've been living with a withered hand for so far all your life, certainly another 24 hours isn't going to make that much difference. And then Jesus could be the great hero. Because after all, healing on any day except the Sabbath day would be just fine. But he pushes it. He's going to do it on the Sabbath day in the synagogue, knowing that that will cause trouble. Note the question, verse 4. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or to kill? In terms of our little ordering here, Jesus ups the ante now. That the whole way of purity codes and that kind of authority and institutional alienization that we usually have in all of our conditional kinds of communities and ways of living, Jesus finally says, are the ways of death. Those ways of living with one another finally kill us off. Jesus proposes a way of life, and that is a way of compassion and justice. A way of unconditional grace and love at work. And so again, note their response. They were silent. He doesn't even have to tell them at that point, shut up. They know that when he says, I'm going for life, they have no control over him. And as we see at the end there in verse 6, the only solution now is destruction. The only way they can reestablish their order is they must annihilate this whole way of compassion and justice and life. That's the only way. These two ways cannot be compatible. They are in conflict with one another. And so there is that sense of annihilation. Right? Jesus, in choosing the way of life, is marked for death. Right? We know that by Jesus choosing to heal this man on the Sabbath, if you will, he's just signed his death certificate. The cross is now inevitable. And so too for us. If we are going to be communities of compassion and justice that promote ways of life, let's not be Pollyannish about this. Let's not think, oh, and everybody's going to say, wonderful, let's give them all Holden hugs and we'll live happily ever after. Nonsense. They're going to be out to get you. Because if you're going to live this way, you can't live this way. My really nasty way of talking about our contemporary society and culture and the way we live, I'm running is that I think, finally, we have to admit it, we're necrophiliacs. We love death. And we love to make love with death. Think about the violence in our society and the way in which we love to control things through that notion of violence. In terms of what's happening at Holden this week, if you haven't talked to Jonathan Frericks about landmines or seen that video on landmines, there's one very small snippet that shows how our culture and basically our world is necrophiliac. Landmines aren't going to win wars, but they do terrorize people and make sure that life, economically, socially, politically, and religiously, for all sorts of people, will never happen. Because every time you want to go out and plant something in your land, you might blow yourself up. And we love it, because that's how we can keep control and power. Or think about the way in which we categorize ourselves as what? A consumer society. Well, if we consume, we consume at what? The expense of somebody else. Somebody has to do without, and quite frankly, somebody has to die so that I can live well. And I love it. Isn't it great? You know? Think of all those poor starving people over there so I can live. Yeah, makes you kind of feel good, doesn't it? But we certainly don't feel bad about it. Are we changing our lifestyle significantly? Are we redistributing wealth and resources? Are we in that sense, and let's say this is what all this is about, are we truly practicing Sabbath? Sabbath isn't something bad. Remember, Sabbath was a day of rest, and Sabbath year and Jubilee year were times of redistribution. So to make sure that everyone would always have enough. Under this way of ordering, Sabbath, when it got into the hands of the lawyers and the pastors and the legislatures and the profs and the accountants, was a way of restrictions. It all of a sudden became conditional to say, if you keep all these Sabbath codes and rules and regulations, then you're a pure, pious, good person. And if you can't do that because you are too poor or because you are unclean for some other reason or whatnot, well, then tough luck for you. See you in hell. Goodbye. Excluded and out. And so all of a sudden, a Sabbath that was meant to be a gift of compassion and justice and life from God turns into a way of restriction and control. And Jesus says, no way. It's not going to be that way, and I oppose it. In communities of faith, pick your side. End of spiel. Mm-hmm.